Language and Appearance was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 11, 2004 at McKinsey Study Center's Tuesday night class. This is the seventh talk in part three of a series entitled Doing Christianity. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
The topic for the series this whole year has been basically inspired by the question, we're Christians, now what? You know, what should we do? How should we live the life? And this spring we've been focusing on things that tend to be one way or the other problematic issues with regard to what we as Christians think about how we should live the life. So our topic today is language and appearance, the dual topic of language and appearance. And maybe it's obvious, maybe it's not obvious, but my comments will be pretty scattered and fragmented and random, so I want to show you the unity right up front and then depart from it. The question really basically is, what about swearing? And in my day, it was, what about long hair for men? But in your day, it's probably rings and tattoos. So what about swearing and what about rings and tattoos? So whatever I have to say is supposed to have something to do with that. The first thing to comment on, I think, is, because I'm just going to draw your attention to this and then I'm going to leave it. But this is the most important point of all, I think, even though I'm not going to talk about it. But Ron talked last week about, in Romans 12, about what about issues that are controversial where we don't exactly, are not exactly on the same page as believers. And if you were here last week or if you remember last week, Paul's teaching in Romans 12 basically is we need to love each other, and part of loving each other is we need to understand that sometimes we don't have a perspective to know exactly what's true. And so we need to get off one another's back and appreciate and respect when people are seeking to serve their Lord in the best way that they know and understand how to do that in their given time, place, history, culture, and situation. God is not going to judge the success of their efforts and the purity of their efforts. He's going to judge the intent and purity of their heart, in effect. And so that's why Paul says, on the one hand, those of you more enlightened dudes who actually know what's going on, don't hold in contempt the weaker brother, the one whose understanding is in some way deficient, the one whose understanding is in some way naive or misguided in some way. You who know better, don't hold that brother in contempt. They're trying. Their heart is right. They're wanting to serve the Lord. Never mind that they don't have the right perspective on everything. They're still trying to serve the Lord, and that's what counts. And on the other hand, those of you who do have that deficient perspective and misguided, and some, no one actually puts themselves in that category, but some of you, out of a deficient and misguided perspective, are getting all condemnatory toward people who are exercising some freedom that you're not exercising, and he's saying, cut it out. Back off, relax. If you're right and they're wrong, the Lord will show them in time. They will grow, they will be sanctified, they will be instructed, and in time they'll come to see it the way you see it, if you're right. So give one another some space. And the whole point of his chapter is on both sides of that issue, to let love ultimately rule. Make a judgment about the heart of the person, the authenticity of their faith, and then accept them, embrace them as a brother, even if you don't agree altogether on what implications that has for certain lifestyle decisions and actions that you might take. Well, with respect to both language and appearance, that's the primary teaching that we need to understand. We may not agree on earrings. We may not agree on tattoos. We may not agree on a few swear words. But the most important thing is that we not let something that superficial, that on the surface of our faith, to stand in the way of us recognizing the authenticity of one another's faith. That's Paul's primary teaching on all such issues. Okay, so that's, I think, the most important thing that can be said, and I'm not going to talk about that today. What I'm going to talk about is, okay, that's how we should handle one another, that's how we should respond to one another and deal with one another, but how do we decide which of us is the weaker and which of us is the stronger on this issue? I mean, that is important, after all. I'm going to talk in two parts, first about language and then about appearance. Okay, when it comes to the biblical assertions, there's probably really only one passage that people could go to that you could interpret as no swearing. There are probably a half dozen that people one way or another might refer to, but there's really only one that could really be, I think, plausibly understood in that way. And that's Ephesians 5. Let me read that. Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma. But immorality or any impurity or greed must not even be named among you, as is proper among saints. And there must be no filthiness and silly talk or coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. For this you know with certainty, that no immoral or impure person or covetous man who is an idolater has an inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Now, there are other passages. Colossians 3:8 talks about put aside anger, wrath, malice, slander, and abusive speech from your mouth. Some people would look at that and say, "That's don't swear." Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. Some people might see no swearing in there. Let no one look down on your youthfulness, but rather in speech, conduct, love, faith, and purity, show yourself an example of those who believe. Some people would look at that and recognize, obviously, our speech needs to show us as an example, and therefore that means no swearing. Likewise, urge the young men to be sensible in all things. Show yourself to be an example of good deeds with purity and doctrine, dignified, sound in speech, which is beyond reproach, so that the opponent will be put to shame, and so on. Now, I'm not going to take the time, unless you have questions about it, to go into each and every one of those passages. That would take more time than we have. But let me just summarize my assessment of what those passages are talking about. There's three things, really, that he's talking about in those passages. One is the speech in that last passage has to do with whether or not we're speaking the truth or speaking error and deceit and lies in our worldview and the doctrines that we teach. What is it exactly are we teaching? Sound speech is speech that is speaking the truth. The truth about Jesus, the truth about God, the truth about sin, the truth about righteousness, all the fundamental foundational issues of the faith, I can either speak truly about them or I can tell lies on the same issues. Sound speech is to speak the truth, and that's what Paul was talking to Timothy about. The abusive speech that he talks about in Colossians recognizes, as James spends a whole chapter on in the letter to James, my tongue is an incredibly sensitive barometer of my heart, of the commitments of my heart, of my beliefs, of my desires, of my understanding. I mean, there's no more telling window into a person's soul than what they say and what they talk about. That seems to be a fairly significant theme in the New Testament teaching. Well, abusive speech is talking about the way in which my tongue can be a barometer of the hatred, the seething hatred, the jealousy, the enmity, the pride, the anger, and so on. The seething cesspool of my heart is going to make its way into what I say to other people. I use speech like a weapon at times. I use speech to hurt. I use speech to wound. And obviously, the immorality of that is not in the speech per se, but it is in the hatred and the murder and the wounding that I am intending through my language and through my words. And obviously that's unrighteous. Obviously that's immoral. And I think that's what he has in mind in the abusive speech in Colossians. Later, when he says, let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person, there again, the issue is not what sorts of vocabulary you use. The issue is, are you going to speak with wisdom, with the grace, the gift from God of wisdom, and respond to people in wisdom, or not? And he's saying, let it be with grace, seasoned as though with salt, so that you should know how to respond to each person. That is, that you have the wisdom to know what to say, how to guide them, how to encourage them, how to rebuke them, whatever is required, necessary. So that leaves us really with only one passage, and that's the Ephesians passage, where conceivably he could be talking about what we think of as swearing. There must be no filthiness and silly talk or coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. Now here's the question. When he talks about, first of all, it's problematic exactly how we should even translate these Greek words. They're not used a lot in our literature. So there could be some debate as to how even best to translate them. But let me take the translation at face value. Filthiness, silly talk, or coarse jesting. What is his concern? What Christian culture, certainly as it was in my childhood, and to some extent still today, although Christian culture has changed radically since my Sunday school days, but what the history of Christian culture in this country has tended to do is to see the filthiness of filthy talk and the coarseness of coarse jesting to reside in the vocabulary that we use. I would argue that that's not what Paul has in mind. I don't think Paul has a linguistic theory that says some phonemes are inherently evil. A phoneme is what a linguist calls a unit of language, of spoken language. The sounds that I make with my tongue and my vocal cords, that's a phoneme. And in my childhood growing up, I was certainly left with the impression that certain phonemes are inherently evil, and they will defile you just by letting that phoneme be emitted from your mouth. I was tortured as a young kid in like 9, 10 years old, because you'd go to school and you'd hear all kinds of phonemes that people weren't people were looked down on for emitting those phonemes, and I'd have this thing going on in my head where for me it wasn't even emitting it from my mouth, it was letting it be in my imagination, in my head itself. I had to purge my thinking of those words. So I developed these little mantras. I mean, to say God or Jesus Christ or something like that was pretty commonplace. So the only way I could redeem the emergence of those words in my head was to finish the sentence, God is good, or Jesus Christ is Lord, or something like that. And so I'd make sure that there were assertions that I was coming up with. But I will never forget, I was a space case. I was a weird little kid, I'm sure. And there's this really cool guy who'd flunked a couple grades who was in my class, and he was older and more mature, and he was just the most important guy in class. And he never gave me the time of day. He never even acknowledged my existence. Well, one day I was walking down the road, and lo and behold, this guy is walking down the sidewalk toward me. Well, normally he would just sort of look right through me and past me and not acknowledge me, but he said hi to me, and that just absolutely put me on cloud nine with elation. I was just elated out of my ever-loving mind. I crossed the street, I tripped over a tree trunk, and out of my mouth came shit. I don't know why I told that story. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's that's right. Well, I mean, all of my training, you know, everything in my training had told me that I was completely and totally defiled. And I was really in conflict here, because one of the reasons that it slipped out was because I had been put off my guard emotionally by this very positive experience in my life. And immediately I was thrown into this conflict, in this turmoil. How can such an awful, evil thing come out of what I had experienced as such a good thing? And it took me years to get an answer to that. But my point was how tortured I was by the prospect that it was the phoneme itself, either spoken or thought in the imagination, that was the evil of swearing. Well, my contention is that's not what Paul's thinking when he says this. And one of my contentions first of all, because it's such a weird idea when you stop to think of it. It's a completely weird idea. Shit is evil and dirty. Feces is simply an acceptable English word to describe an object in the world. Why is one dirty and one not dirty? Why would one be evil and the other not be evil when they denote, you know what I mean by denote, some language actually points to objects in the world, and what it points to is the denotation of a word. When they denote exactly the same thing in the world, why would the phoneme that you use to denote something be evil in one case and not evil in another? That, all you have to do is begin to think about it, and it doesn't really make any sense. Now, I will argue that part of the culture was that there are some things that shouldn't even be denoted. And that's part of what lay behind that in our culture. And we'll talk about that in a second. But we'd even lost sight of that by the time I'm growing up in Christian culture. It's not the denotation that is the problem. It's the phoneme itself. Well, that's a bizarre idea. And that can't possibly be what Paul is talking about. I would argue that in Philippians, we treat it very gingerly in our English translations. But if you remember a passage where Paul's talking about his righteousness and he counts it all as, sometimes they translate it refuse, sometimes filth maybe. Can't remember how the translations all translate it. But the word is feces. And so to capture the emotional import of what he's saying, the best way to translate Paul there would be, I count it all as shit in order that I might know the surpassing greatness of the power of Jesus Christ. Well, I mean, that actually captures emotionally the sentiment of Paul much better than anything else that we could translate it with. Our translators, of course, don't go that way. But my point is, I think Paul is not afraid of admitting that human beings produce waste, that that's a reality, and that it has a certain metaphorical value in certain contexts, and I don't think he's afraid of admitting that. So he doesn't have the sensibilities that much of modern Christian culture do in that regard. So what's he talking about in Ephesians 5:4? I think what he's talking about is the content of our ideas, not the vocabulary that we use to express it. When I was in college, I worked in a factory that produced concrete sewer pipe with a bunch of men that had been there for years and years and years, and these were not Christian men. And every break, the conversation was identical at every break. When they weren't teasing me for being a virgin, they were talking about women and the anatomy of women and their exploits with women and various topics revolving around sex or alcohol. And that was the sum and the substance of their life. Now, it seems to me that's what Paul is talking about. And I don't know if you, I don't know if you women have had a comparable experience, but any of you men know what I'm talking about. I mean, know the way in which the actual minds, the group think of a group of men can go to the gutter. And it is thinking of sexuality in strictly animal and physicalistic terms. There's nothing sacred about sex for them. There is nothing respectable. I mean, women are not being respected. They're being objectified, clearly, obviously. It is a really ugly scene from a biblical perspective. I mean, from the perspective of truth, it is an incredibly ugly scene. I hated break time. I felt so defiled. I felt like I was abused in the situation because I was being drugged into this conversation that I didn't want to be in. I didn't respect it. I didn't like it. I didn't think it was true. And I found it, frankly, outrageous and shocking. Well, I think what Paul is talking about in Ephesians 5 is that shouldn't be our conversation. Don't let that be our conversation. Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children and walk in love just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma. But immorality or any impurity or greed must not even be named among you as is proper among the saints. And there must be no filthiness and silly talk or coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks, which has always confused me. But I'm in a Bible study the other day where this suggestion made a lot of sense to me. The rather giving of thanks is going back to verse 1 and 2. Jesus gave himself an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma. So how should we respond? With lives of impurity and immorality and filthiness and silly talk and coarse jesting? No. With lives of gratitude to God for Jesus, for the offering that he's given us. Okay, so I make a distinction between the content of my speech and the phonemes and the vocabulary that I use in my speech. For Paul to say, my Pharisaical righteousness was nothing but bullshit, I don't think is sinful and evil. I think that's perfectly true. It's dead on right, and one of the most powerful ways he could say that. And to say that in that way, to call that evil, is to completely misunderstand what the issues are. On the other hand, I could objectify a woman and completely degrade human sexuality in my attitudes and the way I talk about things and never once use a swear word, never once use a dirty word in doing so, and yet it would be an utterly and completely evil speech. Now, often those come together, I will grant you, that what we think of as coarse language and coarse vocabulary will get bound together with utterly ugly attitudes and ugly ideas and ugly sentiments. And then, of course, it's evil as well. But it's not evil because of the vocabulary. It's evil because of the viewpoint and the sentiment that's being expressed. Understandably, as part of our culture, I think it's the marrying of the two that often gives swear words a bad name. Okay, let me just think about some of the sources of the Christian culture's attitude toward, I'll call it, foul language. I think it comes from a lot of different directions, I think. In part, not entirely, but in part, I think it seems to be the result of a morphing of a class, of a snobby class judgment into a moral judgment. Some of you will be old enough to recognize that in our childhood, there was still a hangover of, I mean, it was almost as important that I say isn't rather than ain't as it was that I don't use swear words. Why? Because there was this incredibly strong feeling that you wanted to use that language that showed people how educated you were, showed people that you could belong to the upper class and not the lower class. And it was really not about morality, and it really wasn't even about piety at all. it was really about economics and social standing more than anything else. And I think the two get blended together. The lower classes, of course, used all the foul language in their speech. But upper class people, they have very refined speech. They could cut you to the quick with sarcasm and decimate you, but boy, did they use it with the king, the queen's English. And that was part of, I think, in America, that was part of the impulse behind keeping our speech clean. It wasn't even about morality, but this show of class consciousness. Well, from the biblical perspective, that in of itself is already evil. To judge a person's respectability according to the class of their language is an evil judgment to make. Some of the most respectable, intelligent people I know have a totally lower class dialect of English that they use. But big deal, they use it well. They're wonderful at it. It's not my dialect. It's not an academic dialect. It's not a doesn't show education, but they sure say some wise and smart things with that language. And it's far more important what you say than how you say it, is clearly the biblical perspective. To speak wisdom with uneducated English is a whole lot better than speaking nonsense eloquently. The other part of it, I think, is the result of Victorian attitudes. We've talked about this in other contexts that some of you have been a part of. The Victorians had the attitude that, I won't go into the whole worldview, but the Victorians were deeply interested in running away from reality and running away from the real world. They particularly wanted to run away from sexuality. And because they wanted to run away from sexuality altogether, they actually ran away from everything physical, tended to. You know, the Victorians are the ones who made sure they had really, really long tablecloths on tables because you didn't want the knee of the table leg showing. You know, bizarre. But that was the world that they lived in. And accordingly, much of Victorian culture bred this kind of denial of the physical reality of our existence. They would have preferred to believe that we are not actually sexual beings, and for that matter, would have preferred to believe that we are not physical beings. So even the idea that we defecate was gross. And accordingly, something to not be in any way acknowledged. So your language needed to participate in an utter and complete denial of the reality of our physical being and our physical existence. I think that, as much as anything, went into, in the early part of the 20th century and up till today, went into the Christian cultural attitude that those are dirty words, that those are evil words. That's ultimately, of course, goes way back to Plato and the early Greeks. That the physical was degrading, disgusting, inferior, ultimately immoral, and that judgment has wound its way through history and still affects us to some extent today. Another part of, I think, in Gutenberg, some of us just read de Tocqueville, and he made an interesting point that I never noticed before in there. He compares the American women in the early 1800s with the French women in the early 1800s. And he's very much admiring how Americans view their women. And one of the distinctions that he makes is that the Americans don't seem to be afraid to have their women know things, you know the harsh realities of life. I mean, things like that people are immoral sexually and talk about those things and talk about the issues around those things. Whereas the French try to protect their women from that. And I think that comes from a mythology that women are angels / playthings, but women are angels. And as such, they need to stay pure. Whenever you see literature and movies and things about Europe, that kind of comes through. the male attitude that we men, it's okay for us to engage the real world in all of its ugliness and with all of its dirt, but we need to keep women from even talking about this and thinking about this. I think that's certainly part of it as well. And that the hangover of that, it's not true anymore, but it wasn't that long ago in my childhood where men would swear around each other, but if a woman walked in the room, they would stop. They wouldn't use that kind of language around women. I think that's where that's coming from. Okay, so basically, I'm saying, for the most part, with respect to swearing and foul language and so on, I really don't think it's primarily a moral issue. It just isn't, from a biblical perspective, on the one hand. On the other hand, we do need to keep in mind that the language that I do choose to use is itself a message. If I choose to use foul language, I may very well be, in certain contexts, be saying something about myself and my commitments and so on. The medium is an important part of the message itself. It's not just what I'm saying, but how I'm saying it becomes a part of the message. I need to be sensitive to that and alert to that when I make my choices. I need to ask myself along the way, is the message that I am sending not just with the content of my words, but with the medium that I'm packaging it in, is the message I'm sending true? Because that, fundamentally, from the biblical perspective, that's what we're interested in. I need to be speaking the truth rather than a lie. So is what I'm saying true? So the possible messages that we're sending with my enlightened use of foul language, for example, would be, I'm cool, or talking like this is cool, or talking like this is more enlightened than you people who are restricted in your vocabulary, and so on. Or anyone who doesn't talk like this is out of it. And we have to admit, the human heart, the evil and deceitfulness of the human heart is such that that's often what we're doing. We're sending the message that I'm better than you are, I'm more enlightened than you are, I'm freer than you are, I'm more hip than you are, one way or the other. Well, really? Is that what I want to do? Is impress the world with how enlightened I am and how free I am? That's the very thing that in Romans 14, did I say 12 earlier? Romans 14 is concerned that we not do, that we actually serve one another, that we love one another, that we measure, when possible, we measure the impact of our choices on other people to make sure that ultimately our impact is edifying rather than destructive in their lives. Okay, let me shift to appearance. There are even fewer passages on this in the Bible, but the one passage that is there is very, very important, very profound, and very clear, it seems to me. It's actually two passages, but it's the same message in both passages. In 1 Timothy 2, verse 9, he says, "Likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing." Now, I'm going to retranslate this. I think the New American Standard misses the whole point here. "Likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, with reverence and sophrosune." I'll talk about that in a second. "Not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly garments, but rather by means of good works, as is proper for women making a claim to godliness." I'll come back to that and explain that in a second. The other passage is in 1 Peter 3. "Your adornment," again speaking to women, "your adornment must not be merely external, braiding the hair and wearing gold jewelry or putting on dresses, but let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. For in this way, in former times, the holy women also who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. And you have become her children if you do what is right without being frightened by any fear." Okay, they're both making the same point. Don't concern yourself with outward appearance, period. Doesn't matter, doesn't count. It's not interesting. It's not important. What you should concern yourself with is how you adorn yourself inside. And how should you adorn yourself inside? With good works. Be a certain kind of person. I love the language he uses, that imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit. There's a beauty to that that is a profound and deep beauty that no outward beauty is any match for, at least for anybody who has the eyes to see, for anyone who is interested in anything important. So that's the message of both passages. Let me look at the 1 Timothy passage first. That 1 Timothy passage is the controversial passage about I do not permit women to teach or exercise authority over men, and so on. As I understand the issue in that passage, Paul is concerned because some of the women are basically wanting to take on a role that is parallel to and analogous to the role that the men are taking in the Christian community in their teaching ministry. Now, why is that a problem? And that's obviously the controversial issue about that passage. In my judgment at this point, as best I understand what Paul is concerned about, is you have to remember that if you were a woman in that day and age, you were married, you just were, and in all probability you had children. So you're not just talking about women. Paul is not just talking there about women. Paul is talking about wives and mothers there. And his concern is that these women who are wives and mothers are wanting to play the same role that their husbands would be playing. Why is that a problem? I think it's only a problem to the extent that they're abandoning other roles that have been given to them, namely, especially, their role as mothers. I mean, how could they not? Because later, to Titus, he tells the older women to teach the younger women. I don't think he has any problem with them having roles as teachers, but he's talking about older women who are beyond the age of nurturing children at that point. They now have the social latitude to take on a teaching role. But as young mothers, they have their very biology from God, given to them by God, has defined for them their role. Your role is to raise your children. And I think Paul's concern is you're wanting to abandon a role that is clearly and unmistakably the role that God has given you for another role that looks glitzier to you. That's why he says, I think, likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, with reverence, or it's hard to know how to translate that, with reverence and sophrosune. Both of those words, that's the word translated reverence there is used only once in the New Testament. It's right here. Sophrosune is used two or three times in this chapter. Sophrosune, I would argue, is a virtue that we have where we don't try to break outside the boundaries and the limits that God has placed on my life. I accept what God has given me. If I'm blind, I have two ways I can respond to it. Damn it, God, I don't want to be blind. Whoops. I already gave that. I don't want to be blind. Or so be it. God, you have made me blind. Let me live the life that you have given me. If you are poor, you can spend your life in bitter resentment that God has made you poor, or you can thank God for the life that he's given you and accept it, live in it. It's that inner quietness of heart that accepts whatever God has given in defining me and my existence that the Greeks would call sophrosune, I believe. I think what Paul is concerned about here is that that he has women in this church who are restive, who are discontent with the role that has been given them as women. what I have to be a mother, what I have to do this thing, just because of my biology? And I think Paul's position is there's a problem here. Every human being, man or woman, needs to accept what it is that has been given them by God. It's not only women that need to practice sofrasune, men do as well. It's just that there are certain biological realities, I would argue, that make women suited to be mothers and fathers not suited to be mothers. And the children need mothers to mother them. They need mothers to play that role in their life. And it's very time consuming. It's very preoccupying. It takes you out of, it limits the options that are available to you. That's what women in the 20th century have really been complaining about. I mean, in the feminist movement, that's one of the things that they're complaining about, is I don't like the fact that biology has, they wouldn't say God, but that biology has played this dirty trick on us. And so can't we circumvent biology? Can't we get rid of this? Well, I think that's the same attitude that Paul's addressing here. And what he's calling, and I would argue that reverence is basically a synonymous kind of attitude here, that we have a respect for the God who determines my existence and who defines my existence. I don't defy him, but I respect his right to do that. So the two combined, reverence or respect and sofrasune, I think is directed at a particular problem here. I want you to have that heart attitude and that inner orientation that he says adorns you. Now, he doesn't mean it adorns women in a way that it doesn't adorn men. It adorns any human being. It is the true beauty of any human being, male or female. It just happens that he's talking about a problem here with respect to how women are potentially discontent and rebelling against what God has made them to be. Okay, but the main point is the only thing that he's saying about apparel or outward dress in that passage or in the other one is if you want to know how to adorn yourself, don't worry about how you adorn yourself on the outside. Only worry about how you adorn yourself in the spirit on the inside, with good works, with virtues, with the kind of quality of person that you are from the inside out. It's the only thing that counts. Okay. Having said that, I think there are several biblical values that I'd like to outline here. Only one has been made explicit, the one I just mentioned. These others, I think, however, are implicit and can be derived from other biblical teaching. The first is, it seems to me that with respect to dress and body image, it's important that I not communicate sexual availability by means of my dress. It's what we typically call modesty. But I think we need to be clear on what is modest. What do we mean by modest? And I would say that we're not communicating sexual availability. There's two ways to be sexually available. One is to be literally available for sex. The other is to simply make myself visually available for the opposite sex. And it seems to me that on the one hand, understands sex all too well. It understands that sexuality can be visual and merely visual, that literally fornication can be nothing but visual, I think. On the one hand, on the other hand, it can be just sort of naive about the way I'm dressing and the impact of the way that I'm dressing. So it does seem to me that by extension of the Bible's teaching on sexuality, we could conclude that it is unbiblical to be immodest, to dress immodestly by that definition. Now that's to some extent going to be culturally relative. What is immodest in this culture? No, let me put it this way. What is probably relatively modest in this culture would have been immodest in my childhood. No question about that. And that changes over time, and that's fine. To be, you know, we play, our sexuality is somewhat plastic, and we play with it all the time and reshape it and mold it. And there's nothing to say that we can't be in tune with the realities of our culture up to a point. But there comes a point where some immodesty is just flat out immodest in any culture. Second point, and again, I think we can derive this from other biblical teaching, is that we not use dress to boast or present ourselves as more important than we actually are, to put on airs by means of our dress, or to try to create artificial value for ourselves and importance for ourselves by the way that we dress. That's a huge, huge problem. We become obsessed with and pay attention to style, to brand names, all to just simply communicate something about either our social standing or our hipness or our taste or our being with it, our being cool in some way or the other. None of that should be important to those of us who are believers. That's just a silly game. And we as believers of all people shouldn't be playing it. Why, we've talked about these two passages. The third point is that the outer appearance is not important. It just isn't important. What's important is the substance of the inner person. Two reasons, I think. One is, the outer is passing away. It's only the inner reality of who I am that's going to remain everlasting for all of eternity. I am, in my freedom, as I make my choices and resolve my will to go one way or the other, I'm literally sort of creating who I am by my choices. And I'm either creating myself to be someone who is fit and qualified for the kingdom of God to come, or somebody who's not. I'm either creating myself a vessel of mercy prepared for glory, or a vessel of wrath prepared for destruction. Well, that part stays. That part's for keeps. That's eternal. But what's happening to this outward shell that is growing old and withering up and going to blow away is totally unimportant from anything like the eternal perspective that the Bible tells us to have. So that's one reason. The second reason that the outer is not important is because the outer does not embody what truly makes me me, whereas the inner does. The inner reality does. Now, we are in our culture today are trying like crazy to reverse that. It really doesn't make any difference what your character is as long as you look good. And we're just trying like crazy to sell that message and to make that, turn that into a reality. But it's silly. I mean, there's no way we can objectively look at it and not realize how far more important it is to be a person of substance, to be a person of character and depth, than to be a shallow, good-looking shell, superficial shell. I mean, how can there even really be a choice there? And certainly, clearly, the biblical perspective on that is that it's the inner person that counts, that defines who I am. The emphasis today, I used to only know of it in Southern California, but now it's on TV, and I suppose it's going to be nationwide now. The incredible obsession with plastic surgery is just symptomatic of this move in our culture to place the importance on the outward appearance. I mean, even in the churches in Southern California, it's hard to find a woman who has not had plastic surgery. Well, it's a complete capitulation to the spirit of our age and the values of our culture, and a complete disregard for biblical priorities, it seems to me. I just find it very difficult to defend it. By the same token, there's a reverse problem. There can be an obsession with, instead of an obsession with style and good looks and being with it and being contemporary and so on, there can be an obsession with anti-style. you know, you sometimes see among certain segments of the homeschool movement, it's really important, like you look like you stepped out of Little House on the Prairie in order to be righteous and godly or something like that. Well, that is just as much placing the emphasis on outward appearance as the opposite is. You're still defining righteousness and goodness and defining yourself by how you look rather than the inner realities of character. Some of what we do to our bodies, tattoos, rings, and so on and so forth, it is totally innocent, completely just a matter of cultural style and that kind of stuff. But oftentimes it's a lack of self-acceptance. And I would argue that self-acceptance is an important mark of authentic spirituality. When you're as ugly as I am, you'd like to do something to change that. But that's one option. You can sort of change that. Or you can just decide, God made me ugly. It's okay. And ultimately, that kind of heart of self-acceptance is a very important and crucial part of our sanctification. It's a crucial part of wisdom. It's a crucial part of maturity. Is that we allow God to be God. We allow my Creator to be my Creator. God did create some people to be strikingly beautiful in one way or the other, strikingly good looking in one way or the other, and He made others of us to not be. That's fine. It's okay. He made all kinds of differences among us. And the issue that confronts us all is, what am I going to do with the fact that God made me the way He made me? Is that okay with me or not okay with me? How I deal with that question is going to make all the difference in the world, is whether I develop that inner beauty that is so crucial and really counts and is the true beauty. But even how we define beautiful, I think it's another thing that we can abstract from the Bible, is that we need to be fiercely independent of other human beings and therefore of human culture, even in our perception of things. I need to be fiercely independent. In biblical terms, I need to fear God, not man. All too often, we fear man and not God. So, especially in this day and age, we have the media, the fashion industry, all kinds of people around us actually getting inside of our own heads and telling us how to look at the world, telling us what to call beautiful, telling us what to call attractive. And it really is kind of bizarre when you stop to think about it. I mean, in God's scheme of things, He made us come in all kinds of different shapes and sizes. I mean, all you have to do is look around and notice that we come in all kinds of different shapes and sizes. And yet, on our magazines and what's given to us to drool over is an incredibly narrow slice of humanity that is with this message being given to you, this is attractive, this is beautiful, this is interesting. And that changes. That's what's bizarre. I mean, at other times in cultures, it would have been a different slice of humanity that was beautiful. And we, once we allow those cultural values to get inside of our heads, we actually would have been attracted to what today is not attractive to us. We have not been trained to be attracted to that. We have been trained to be attracted to something else. And we, believers of all people, shouldn't be trained to do nothing. We should be fiercely independent. And we should allow ourselves the freedom to learn to see the beauty that is actually there in all kinds of different body shapes and sizes and so on and so forth. There's a lot more beauty out there than we allow ourselves to enjoy because we are so much a victim and a monkey of the media and the fashion industry and the culture. We believers need to think differently about that. Don't allow them to get inside of our heads. Don't allow them to perceive for us. But let the truth of God and the facts of reality train our perceptions rather than our culture. Okay. Just one last comment, and then I'll open it up for your comments and questions. I do think this, for those of you who lived through it, you know what I'm talking about. The rest of you, this is just ancient history, but I mean, it was really funny to be born in the 50s and live through the 60s. When I went to school, every boy in school had exactly the same kind of shoes. We had exactly the same haircut. We used exactly the same butch wax. I mean, we just looked like little cookie-cutter kids in a cookie-cutter culture living in cookie-cutter houses. I mean, it was just your worst nightmare. I grew up in it. And then we hit the 60s, and all hell broke loose, and then it really got bizarre, you know. But there was one really good and biblical thing, I think, that happened in the 60s, and that was the importance of individualism over conformism. I mean, we shook off the conformism of the 50s and believed that we were indeed individuals and we could express our individuality in our dress. I think that's an eminently biblical idea. The fact that we are all individuals created by our Creator, and we are created different, and we have different tastes and different personal values and different personal perceptions and so on. And to respect that and to acknowledge that and to enjoy that and appreciate that, I think is ultimately a very biblical idea. So, I'm sure you have a bunch of questions, so let's stop there and you can have at it.
On the issue of modesty, you said that there are certain things that in any culture would be immodest. And aren't there cultures, though, that like where they practically wear no clothes?
Yeah.
So what would
you
mean by that?
It's really a weird thing. Sexuality is such a mental thing. It's such a mind thing. It's not really so much physical as it is mental. And you could probably have two women dressed identically, and one is being seductive and one is not. And it really has more to do with her own inner attitudes, because that somehow, in a way that I don't really understand, I think makes its way to the surface, manifests itself in body language, and it gets spooky. It just seems like a very, very clear reality to me. Even though I can't see.
Okay, what you had said, you know, about the feminist movement of the 70s, what were women who were doing that? In rebellion against an institution they viewed as male-oriented, or more in rebellion against what God had placed for them?
Well, because it's a part of a larger cultural pattern, I think the reality is they were in rebellion against God, as so many things in the 60s and 70s and through to today are. I mean, it just seems to me the history of our culture is to defy God and to defy truth. Now, were they pinpointing genuine, legitimate abuses? Undoubtedly, yeah. I mean, that was true as well. That there are segments of our society, there were certainly individual marriages that were very abusive and very chauvinistic, and attitudes that were very chauvinistic. I think that's really true. I was somewhat insulated from that. I mean, my own family, my father was very respectful of my mother. And so I grew up with nothing but a very, very high view of women. But I, you know, as you got to see a little bit more about you, not every family was like my family. Some of them were pretty, pretty bad.
On your, I really like the way you've done your talk here. And I think that the main point you're making about certain words not being inherently wrong, and this is very true. And like, then what we do is it's true though that there are certain cultures, subcultures that have certain linguistic things that go along with them that become associated with that lifestyle as such. And I think that's really a lot of why we associate those kind of things with that. But one thing that I've thought about a lot about is what kind of standard though is there as far as like, in place of just having this list of words which are made up arbitrarily as being bad, and things like words like shit, they bothered me when I was younger, and
like,
I was like,
hey,
oh,
what?
They bothered me when I was younger, you know, because
yeah.
I grew up understanding that as being a bad word, but as I got older, I kind of see, well, that's no different really than like you're saying feces. One thing that became though more that I was more sensitive to is words that deal specifically with sexual content, especially. In other words, it seems to me that like when it says that you didn't talk about this, but like one of the things is that we should not use the Lord's name in vain. I am not sure exactly how it's being meant in the Old Testament. It could be that of course they swore by his name since making a promise, and so by taking his name in vain, they were using his name in a way that they were promising something and then they didn't fulfill it. I think that has a lot to do with it. But also, I think just to use his name lightly in an irreverent way. I think sort of the principle there is that things that should be revered and honored shouldn't be used in a common way or made to be dirt, you know, as such. You shouldn't take something which is high and respectable and make it, you know, unrespectable. And I guess that's with words like, and it's partially hard because words like things like that for me have a really strong sexual connotation.
Right.
And it just seems, or, you know, mother F, you know, that's I can understand how sometimes people can be acculturated to a certain point where that doesn't bother them anymore. But for me, that's really offensive.
Right.
And so it just seems to me that there are certain words that have that strong connotation where you're by making them that way, you know, you are sort of violating some sort of a biblical understanding. But what do you think about that? I mean, like, is there, things like sexuality, or it's hard because sometimes some words are used so common that they completely become detached
exactly.
from the kind of connotation they had before.
Right.
And I guess where that comes in is just being sensitive to the fact that there is a meaning out there which is sort of objective based upon cultural use, and then there's the way that I use it. So every time I use it, I'm voting on how it's supposed to be meant, but at the same time, I'm sort of bound to this overarching kind of social perspective that gives.
Right. Yeah, good question. Well, I mean, let me take two. I am so uncomfortable with it that I will have to call it the F word, but I can't use it. I can't make it a part of my vocabulary. I have no desire to make it a part of my vocabulary. It's not all that interesting to me to make it a part of my vocabulary. And the reason it's offensive to me is because for me there is a content to it, and the content is very ugly because it's taking something that is fundamentally sacred and degrading it. And for that reason, I just can't help but I just have a problem with it. On the other hand, if I run into someone who's a believer who's coming out of the ghetto, it doesn't mean anything any longer. It's a punctuation mark for them.
Scotland or Ireland.
Yeah, or Scotland or Ireland. Yeah, it's a punctuation mark. It's no longer. It doesn't have any semantic value at all. It's just color. In the speech, colorful punctuation in the speech. I need to be sensitive to the fact that that's the case, and not, I don't have to talk like they do, but neither should I condemn them for it, because I need to recognize that there's two entirely different things happening. If I were to say it, or if that were to become part of my speech, it would mean something entirely different and have an entirely different significance than it does for them. So I need to make sure that I don't judge them and condemn them for something that I find offensive. And personally distasteful. I mean, for reasons of morality, because I think it's immoral to degrade that which God has made sacred, and to degrade it is immoral. I don't think the Bible is saying when it says don't take the Lord's name in vain. I don't think he's saying don't swear and don't say, oh God. he's not objecting to that. I think what he's saying there is, don't name the name of God as your God. Don't take Yahweh as your God in vain. That is, as an empty assertion, as an empty claim. If you're going to name the name of Yahweh, then keep his covenant. Don't pretend that Yahweh is your God and then live as if he's not your God. I think that's what he means by don't take the Lord's name in vain. Otherwise, I don't think he's saying one way or the other. Now, by the same token, for the same reason that I have trouble with the F word, I have trouble with the G word. If I think of God as actually God, a reference to the creator being, I mean, of all the things in the world to use as an interjection is the name of God Most High, that just seems to trivialize who the God Most High is, and therefore I have a problem with that, and I can't make that a part of my speech. But again, I have to put that in perspective. In Valley Talk, it's not even spelled the same way. It's G-A-W-D, you know. It doesn't mean the creator of the universe. It's just an interjection. And again, as much as I can't make it and don't want to make it a part of my speech, I have to not judge them because I know it's habit. I mean, they're not thinking. They're not purposing anything by that any more than they are when they say like, obviously. So I just need to cut them some slack and not stand in judgment on them. But there's no virtue in me making it a part of my speech either, you know, unless I just get absorbed into that culture.
I have a question on the language part of it.
Okay.
It seems to be a big part of reality that the way you speak, or even, I guess this goes with both sides of it, or even the way you dress, will tell your culture at large something about who you are. And although I can look at someone and say, even if they dress immodestly or swear, that I can say, okay, well, no, that's not necessarily defining who they are. They can be something other than that. But the fact is that the culture as a whole does perceive people a certain way based on how they dress or speak. So how much do you give grace to that and be careful because of that issue? Like for me, I came out of a culture where swearing is a huge no-no. So if I come into a culture where it's fine to swear and then I start swearing, that's really jarring for a lot of people because they had already based their view of who I am. I mean, it's kind of a sticky, I guess I have two separate questions in there. But one would be, how do you deal with how the culture views you based on your appearance and speech? And the other would be, what do you do when you're in two opposite cultures?
Okay. Well, I don't remember how far Ron got into this last week, but when Paul is dealing with the issue of controversial issues not in the Romans passage, but in the 1 Corinthians passage, there's something there he says that's very helpful. That's meat offered to idols. And he says, if somebody invites you over for dinner and they give you some meat to eat, eat it. Don't worry about it. Doesn't matter where it came from. But if somebody comes up to you and says, did you know that that meat was offered to idols? Then don't eat it for conscience sake. And then he adds, not your conscience sake, but his. That I think what's very helpful about that passage being there is that always, for me, when I was growing up and I was growing my hair exceedingly long and my mother kept quoting the passage, you don't want to be a stumbling block to other people. The way... Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The way that passage got interpreted was, don't you ever, ever do anything, anytime, anywhere that some anonymous person might be offended at. And that's exactly not what Paul's saying. He's going out of his way to saying, if you don't know how people are going to respond to it, relax. Just live your life. Just exercise the freedom that you know you have in Christ and don't worry about it. But if you're dealing with a known quantity, someone makes it known to you somehow, or you're aware of a brother or sister who is going to be sent the wrong message by your action, then love demands that you control your behavior such that you not send them a destructive message. But he flips it backwards from the way it got used in back in my generation. Instead of saying, you know, you don't know, but somebody out there is likely to be offended by it, so you conform. Don't you do anything different because you don't want to make anybody to stumble. That's Paul's saying exactly the opposite. He's saying relax and live your life. But if you know the effect of your actions on someone else, do what love would demand in that case and don't practice your freedom.
But for you, growing your house, wasn't that seen as just living your life, but to the older generation it was seen as an absolute act of rebellion?
Absolutely, and much more so than could possibly be true today. I mean, to the older rebellion, drugs and long hair were just absolutely married forever.
That's not some random person. That's your mother, your aunt, your the men in your church, the men on the street who are older. I mean, that's more than just one or two people that you're afraid of not offending. That's a pretty big chunk of your life.
Well, okay. Second point to make is the way my mother's generation took that verse was, you don't want to do anything that would offend anybody else. And Paul uses that language or it gets translated that way. But what offend meant to my mother was make them have a cow. What offend means to Paul is cause them destruction. Like in a criminal offense where you victimize someone by your action, that's the sense of the word offend there. Where, in other words, he says, make them stumble. And stumble is not ruffle their feathers, you know. Ooh, he has long hair. It's not ruffling their feathers. It's you're walking down a mountain trail and you trip over a rock and hurl 1,000 feet to your death and destruction. That's stumbling. I mean, that's the way it gets used in the New Testament. So what he has in mind is where your action, I think Ron talked about this last week, where your action actually models behavior that is in violation of his conscience, and the only way they can follow your lead is by hardening their conscience against God. Well, that's a bad thing to do, for someone to harden their conscience against God and to say, God, doesn't really matter to me what you think, I'm going to do this anyway. That's a destructive, spiritually destructive behavior. Is my behavior leading someone to that? Why would I do that? I mean, I don't want to do that. But that's very different than going to the Pharisee, like Paul did. And the Pharisee says, you can't be saved and be circumcised. And Paul says, Titus, be circumcised, or whichever. he's deliberately offending them. He's rubbing it in their nose. And that's more like what was the case in my generation, is it was self-righteous. It was a kind of ignorant equation with faith and righteousness and godliness with American conformity, American cultural conformity, and it needed to be shaken, I think. I wasn't wise enough to be the one doing it. I was just doing it to be cool, but if I had my wits about me, I should have done it anyway. You know?
So then the distinction that you're making there is almost that the older generation would not have followed you, and if it had been a younger kid who would follow you, and even though he knew it was like this horrible rebellious thing, then it would be something you would need to reconsider?
Yeah. There were times where I did see on a firsthand basis what Paul was talking about, that I would sort of model certain lifestyle issues, and then I would see someone else kind of feeling the freedom that I felt, but they were taking it in a radically different direction, a very radically wrong direction. And I saw the power of example. You know, I went, whoa, this is dangerous stuff. And I need to be careful. I need to make sure that I'm clear, that people understand why I have the freedom that I have and what I don't have the freedom to do, and what the difference is. I can't just indiscriminately model any old behavior and not pay attention to the message I'm sending. So that was with this generation. But the older generation was not going to follow us. I mean, that wasn't the issue. I wasn't about to get my father and his generation to grow their hair long and start smoking dope. I mean, it just wasn't going to happen.
So you're making the distinction then between, like you were talking about the older generation, just that like they're not making choices about how they're going to live. They're just upset at what you're doing, and they just think you're sinning, and you're fine with that, but you're not fine with people who are making those choices, and they're taking what you are doing and either doing it against their conscience or going the other way.
Exactly.
Is that the distinction?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. That's really clear. I mean, if you read those passages, that's clearly what Paul's worried about. He's not worried about offending people in our sense of ruffling their feathers.
What about going from one culture to another? Like with swearing, if you come from a culture that's only anti-swearing and then you come into a culture that's fine with it.
I think then Paul's advice to be all things to all people is important. When I'm a Jew, I become like a Jew. When I'm a Gentile, I become like a Gentile. In the right setting, I wouldn't dare use. I won't promise. in the right setting, I would try very, very diligently to not say anything foul and toward inappropriate. But in other settings, I would feel free. And indeed, sometimes I'd feel that, and then in other situations, I'd feel absolutely compelled to make sure I swear. In the same way that Paul made sure that he circumcised Titus. Because they need to confront the truth about the gospel. What's important? What counts? What is this really all about? Did Jesus come into the world to rid the world of swearing? I mean, that in the church I was growing up with, that would have been a valid option. I mean, that's sort of the message. Jesus came into the world so that we have the power not to swear.
I think people would understand your point of how the meaning, both terms for the same thing, how is one right and one wrong. But I think what happened, what I saw happening mostly was that whether or not it denotes the same thing, to have the, like you just said, to have the power, what would be called self-control, to not use it no matter what circumstance and no matter how justified you'd be in using it, even if it was the best term, bring color to an argument, is the badge, I think, that the people, well, I shouldn't say the people, I was probably the same way. You know, it was a goal to aspire to. It was, and if you went ahead and used colorful speech, you're not striving anymore. I mean, you're not striving to aspire to have that kind of, that level of self-control.
I think there's some truth to that, but I would argue the same thing is true not just with respect to swear words, but every part of our speech. Yeah, you know, I need to know how to say isn't as well as ain't. I should, if at all possible, if I'm exposed to what is proper grammar, it'd be better to discipline myself to be able to use proper grammar and then deviate from it at will, rather than not even have the option. I mean, sure, to have some kind of a certain amount of self-control over speech in every regard is an important facility, an important tool, I think. So there's some truth to that, on the one hand. On the other hand, I don't think we're talking about moral discipline there. I mean, there are all kinds of people who probably don't have linguistic discipline, but who are very morally disciplined people, and that's what counts.
Like, I think that I'm pretty clear on how looking one way to Christians and whatnot is important. But how does one deal with the fact that, like, I cuss at work, as I normally would, and it feels like there's some value when a coworker comes up to me and goes, "Hey, Eric, you're religious?" Oh, yeah. And he's like, "Well, but you cuss." And then I explain to him very lightly that I don't think that religious practice is necessarily made out to the way it is and whatnot. But, like, Is there a problem with that? Like, I think there's some inherent good in him going, "Oh, maybe Christians can be real people too." But, like, am I wrong in thinking maybe I'm defacing, like, what Christians can be? I mean, what about the people who go, "Yeah, he obviously doesn't take Christianity seriously." Is that, I mean, am I just to push them off as going, they'd say that anyway?
Well,
yeah.
For anybody that we're going to reach, character is going to speak a lot louder than anything else. They're not going to say you can't be a very serious believer because you cuss. What they are going to see is your kindness, your sacrifice, your lack of selfishness. They are going to see that, aren't they? And that's what's going to speak loudest. And then what it does is the fact that you are not putting on this plastic superficial piety is going to even be more meaningful to them than if your faith is a faith of substance underneath that. Okay? Thank you.